It is well decided, and we agree, that students do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse door. However, it is equally well decided that those constitutional rights will be administered in a way that is sensitive to the school environment.
Welcome to the High School SCOTUS podcast, where we talk about how the decisions of the Supreme Court, in the words of the Constitution, play out behind the schoolhouse gate. I'm Elise Spenner.
And I'm Hannah Saroff.
Again, what a term it's been. We hope you enjoyed our conversation about the court's recent decisions re-religion at the schoolhouse gates and our tremendously fun term recap episodes.
Today, we're going to revisit a case and topic that we haven't really touched on yet, but that we think is super relevant and consequential, unfortunately, to the lives of high school students.
If you haven't noticed, outside of our term relevant episodes, we were kind of going in order of the amendments. So we talked about freedom of speech, freedom of religion. We're going to be talking about freedom of the press. And we thought it was appropriate now to talk about the Second Amendment and how it plays out in schools. We think it's an especially perfect time to broach the subject because the court recently released their opinion in New York City Rifle and Pistol Association, NYSERPA v. Bruin, the most impactful Second Amendment case to reach the Supreme Court in 10 years.
Also, it's an important time to discuss the Second Amendment because I think we all know about the tragedy in Uvalde that happened at the end of the school year, and Bruin doesn't directly connect, but it's just important have that context when we're thinking about Supreme Court cases and how they play out in real life. So in Bruin, the court held that New York could not require applicants for a concealed carry license to demonstrate a special need to have a gun. Basically, New York had something called a may issue regime, meaning that public officials, usually local judges, got to decide if someone could carry a gun around. In New York, you could only do so if the judges thought you had a special need for self-protection that separated you from the general population.
And to clarify, this special need couldn't just be you saying that you had to travel through a high crime area for work, or that you had a lot of experience with guns, or that you carried lots of money around. There had to be some sort of imminent personal threat to your security, generally, for you to be able to get a license.
So, as of right now, when we're recording this introduction, six other states have similar may issue regimes. And these states include some of the most urban concentrated cities in the nation and account for some 25% of the U.S. population.
Hannah's right, and that touches on some important context, which is that even when the court says, just six states, that seems like a very small number, but it's important to remember that these are very concentrated states that have cities like L.A. and like Washington, D.C. and New York City, where huge amounts of people live in very close quarters. The other 43 states either employ a shall issue regime, which means that the person applying for a license must get the license if they satisfy objective standards, or the state just simply allows for permitless carry.
Now, again, I get to do the fun job of saying, guess what happened when the court heard this case? Again, not a surprise. So the court struck down the New York law. The conservative majority argued that they couldn't let a constitutional right be relegated to a select few and under the complete discretion of a government official.
All on the surface, this decision seems rather narrow, and you'd be right to think that. Six states, this specific law about when there is complete discretion given to a government official. In these may issue regimes that give that discretion aren't actually that different from shall issue regimes, because shall issue regimes can still have these pretty rigorous standards as long as they're objective and seemingly everyone could meet them if they took training courses and weren't convicted of a felony or didn't have mental health issues. And so you still have to be a law-abiding citizen to get a gun in shall issue states. But the more ground-shifting element, I think, of the court's decision was a new test it employed and instructed lower courts to follow when determining if gun regulations are constitutional under the Second Amendment, whether those are concealed carry laws, assault rifle ban, laws about who can carry and when they can carry.
So there's this limbo between Heller, which is a previous case, and Bruin, where lower courts, because of this limbo, lower courts adopted a two-step framework for weighing gun laws. First, they determined if the gun law touched on a Second Amendment right. If so, they determined how severely the law infringed on the right, decided on a comparable standard of scrutiny, strict intermediate, and evaluated if the legislature could prove sufficient interest in tailoring to satisfy that standard.
The court in Bruin heard about the fact that basically every single circuit in the nation was using this two-step strategy, and they were like, no way. They said courts should only look to history and tradition when determining if a gun regulation was permissible. The regulation needed to be deeply rooted in the country's history or have a historical analog. That means a regulation from the past that looks almost exactly like the one that we have at hand today. And if the legislature wants to pass a gun law, courts need to be able to point to a similar regulation in U.S. history. Even though today's world, with planes, subways, and cities, and mass shootings would be unrecognizable to the founders, and gun violence is a rising problem that empirical evidence can clearly show is threatening lives around the country.
I remember that I was once asked, if you could give any historical figure a current day technology, what would it be? And honestly, my first thought was I would give George Washington an AR-15, because I think that just seeing that piece of technology would really change the way founders viewed the Second Amendment. And so, like Elise was saying, this new framework of thinking about everything from the past could truly flip the Second Amendment jurisprudence on its head, turning judges and legislators into historians as they attempt to match modern gun laws to historical ones without considering modern needs and interests.
Naturally, Justice Breyer's dissent, joined by the three liberals, was not having it. First of all, Breyer said that solely using history and tradition to evaluate gun laws wasn't appropriate at all. Empirical evidence, public safety interests, evolving circumstances, these are things that all need to be considered by legislatures and judges. In history, despite technically being unchangeable, tends to be really ambiguous. As you'll see in our conversation with Joseph Locher, it's hard to say whether history is on one side or the other in really any case, and it's really easy to cherry pick history to meet the legal outcome you wish to guarantee. Moreover, Breyer really said, why should judges be doing the job of historians? We shouldn't put this on the plate of every single district court and circuit court judge that hears a gun case.
I even had a history teacher, Elise, who felt like essays are really pointless in a history class because students' job is just to tell a story, not history, and just cherry pick what they need to support that claim. And so Justice Breyer kind of does that, as both sides do. And he says, even if you did look at the history, Justice Thomas and the majority got it all wrong because they failed to cite the long tradition of reasonable gun regulations aimed at preserving public safety in America.
And I think what Hannah points out is super interesting in that even though Justice Breyer says that he doesn't want to use a history approach and wants to balance these modern interests with the text of the Second Amendment, he ends up having to play the history and tradition game just because that's the game that the conservative majority is now playing and that lower courts will have to play. And I think, again, perhaps more explicitly than ever, the majority in the Senate are trying to advocate these very different worldviews, very different histories, and very different opinions on how we should wrestle with the problems that plague today's America.
This is just kind of an extension of the polarization, I think, that's happening within politics and law in America. And it raises a lot of questions. So to help us figure it all out, piece it together as much as we can, we're going to go to our fantastic conversation with Professor Joseph Locher.
Professor Joseph Locher teaches constitutional law and the Second Amendment at Duke University School of Law, where he's also the co-director of the Center for Firearms Law. He has commented extensively on gun regulations in the Second Amendment and is the author of The Positive Second Amendment, Rights, Regulation, and the Future of Heller, published by Cambridge University Press. Professor Locher, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you all so much for having me.
We're so lucky to have you here today. And so our first question is, why do you study gun regulations and the Second Amendment?
That's a great question. I sometimes ask myself that because it can be a very contentious area of constitutional scholarship. But I think one is the obvious, just visceral importance of the issue. Gun rights and regulation are related to some of, I think, the hardest challenges that we face as a country. You know, 45,000 people died of gunshots the last year, for which the CDC has data. most of those deaths by suicides, but a rising proportion of gun homicides. That's an extraordinary number. And I think millions of Americans have been traumatized by gun violence, either through threats from intimate partners or violence at schools or in public places. And anything law can do to address those harms is really important. At the same time, millions and millions of Americans are lawful gun owners and use guns for perfectly defensible, if not laudable, purposes like self-defense or hunting or recreation. And so, like, accommodating those two things, like the harms and the benefits, is just a real, real ongoing challenge. The second thing I would say is that, and this is way more sort of in the weeds of like what gets scholars up in the morning, but as a person who's interested in constitutional scholarship, it's rare to find an issue area where there are so many open questions. So in the First Amendment, where I also write, there are probably 1,000 theories out there about the First Amendment and countless, millions probably, of articles and debates and hundreds of good scholars working on the issue. And the Second Amendment is just kind of catching up. Although it's been in the Constitution since 1791, the real focus in law and scholarship is just now starting. So I don't know, it's sort of like being in from the ground level, just pretty exciting.
You might not have had a job in the Second Amendment 30 years ago because people just were not talking about it.
There was a tiny little group, most of them saying the same things back and forth at one another. It was not the diverse and interesting conversation that it is now. And I mean, I guess it's worth noting that one reason for that is that for decades, really until 2008, there was just kind of one question being debated about the Second Amendment. And that question was, is it limited to people and arms and activities that are in some way connected to the organized militia, like is arguably suggested at least by the first clause of the amendment, where it says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of every state? Or option two, does the right extend to include a so-called individual right that includes private purposes like the use of guns for self-defense, which some argue is implied by the second part of the amendment, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So for decades, the scholarly debate was basically just people in Camp A and people in Camp B just lobbing the same arguments back and forth at one another. And let's not say that there wasn't some great scholarship written. There absolutely was, but it was kind of the same debate over and over and over and over again. And fortunately, we've gotten past that, at least to some degree. And now we're considering a whole new range of more interesting questions, I think, like, well, if we accept that there is an individual right to keep and bear arms for private purposes, what kinds of regulations are consistent with that right? Like who gets to exercise, in what places, with which guns? Those are the kinds of questions that we ask about free speech or equal protection or other constitutional rights. So it's kind of like the Second Amendment's like grown up a little bit and the scholarship hopefully is kind of catching up with it.
So let's dive right into NYSERPA versus Bruin because it is really the second Amendment case to come before the court that really considers or accepts the fact that people have an individual right to bear arms. And I want to talk about history because that is so much of what decisions around the Second Amendment are based on and made on today. And while I don't want to get too far into the weeds, do you think either the majority or the dissent can like rightfully claim that history is on their side on this topic of concealed carry outside the home?
It is such a great question, at least, and a hard one to answer. I mean, I think nobody in any side of the debate should claim that all the history is on their side, because it's just not. If one thing I've learned working on this issue over the years is that there are enough historical sources out there to disappoint you, whether you support very broad gun rights or you support very broad gun regulation. This is just tough. It's just tricky. And one of the things that I found disappointing in the Supreme Court's first big decision, District of Columbia versus Heller, was the majority in that case's willingness to sort of read a contested historical record as if it were absolutely certain in one way. And that, I think, just puts too much weight, more weight than the historical sources will bear. Of course, Justice Stevens, in his dissenting opinion in that case, that was kind of the opposite. And says, well, the historical sources point in the other direction. And in my view, it's just, well, history points in a lot of different directions, which we should expect because history contains multitudes and it contains regional differences and differences among different groups. And frankly, it doesn't capture the voices of all the people who lived through it. The folks whose voices are captured in the history that we have access to is a very unrepresentative slice of who was alive in America at any given point. It's mostly a group of elite white men from 1791 or 1868, whatever period you want to look at. The caution I always have in putting too much weight on historical arguments, or one caution at least, is that the historical record just doesn't bear as much weight as some people, I think, want to put on it. After Bruin, I guess I'm even more concerned because the majority in Bruin seems to say that the only kinds of gun regulation that are constitutional going forward are the ones that are, in the majority's view, consistent with our tradition of weapons regulation. But then they don't really tell us, well, what kind of evidence would it take to show consistency with that tradition? Because there are a lot of regulations throughout history. We host here at Duke a free online resource called the Repository of Historical Gun Laws. It's basically just like a free searchable index sorted by state, by subject matter, by time, where you can find 1,600 gun regulations throughout history. And we stopped in 1934. We kept going, we'd find a lot more. So there's a lot of history out there. The real question is, how do you put that together into a tradition? Like, what's the principle you take from it? And I don't think Bruin gave us a lot of guidance on that. I should say, you asked about both the majority and the dissent. Justice Breyer, who writes the lead dissent in this case, also points to history. I think his major complaint, which I share, is just that it's not clear, again, not clear just how much history it takes to satisfy the new tests. If there were three colonies that had gun regulations that looked a lot like the one that the Bruin Court struck down. If three's not enough, how many do you need? Do you need five? Do you need seven? Do you need all 13 colonies? What are we doing here? It's still a little obscure to me, frankly.
Continuing on that train about what history you need to make a decision, there's a lot of debate between the majority and the dissent, and this happens again in Dobbs, about what history is appropriate to include in analysis, and when is it appropriate to examine history going like back to the 13th century? Should post-ratification laws have influence if they are inconsistent with the constitutional test? It kind of seemed like the majority was creating this complex hierarchy of history. So what do lower courts then do with that?
Oh boy, I wish I had an answer to that one, Dana. It's a good question. And I think I really don't envy lower courts trying to apply this opinion, or for that matter, to square it with Dobbs. I mean, Dobbs comes down 24 hours later. It's signed by almost all the same justices who signed the majority opinion in Bruin. I mean, Chief Justice in Dobbs is arguably doing something a little different there, but in Dobbs, they're willing to look back, I mean, centuries before the founding of this country. And in Bruin, the majority opinion is sort of like narrowing the focus more and more and more towards just the framing era, like 1791. Now, they don't come out and answer the question exactly which history matters, like what era are we supposed to look to? And actually, interestingly, this is one of the points that Justice Barrett makes in her concurring opinion in Bruin. So she joins the majority opinion. Then she enters a separate, very short opinion saying, look, we have not answered here the methodological question of, do we look to 1791 when the Second Amendment was ratified, or do we look to 1868 when the 14th Amendment was ratified, which as a matter of technical law is what makes the Second Amendment applicable to the states? Like, we don't really know. But if you read the opinion, the majority opinion, it's very clear that Justice Thomas has kind of given a stiff arm to, you know, pre-colonial history, the English common law heritage, which mattered in Heller, but apparently doesn't matter as much now, or to the post-ratification history, which again, mattered in Heller, but apparently doesn't matter so much now. So I guess to build on what I said a minute ago to answer this question, like, not only is it tricky to know whose history to look for or where we take our history from, but also when. And after Bruin, it's entirely unclear to me. In a way, it kind of compounds a problem that we saw in Heller. So going back to Heller in 2008, the majority there adds this kind of inscrutable paragraph, which has been the centerpiece for Second Amendment litigation ever since then, where they say nothing in our opinion should cast doubt on such longstanding prohibitions as those that apply to felons, the mentally ill, dangerous and unusual weapons, sensitive places, and so on. No citations to support the longstandingness of any of those prohibitions. And as a lot of people have pointed out, it's a little tricky to say that felons, for example, were disarmed in 1791. We didn't even really have the same legal category of felon in 1791. And the big federal law that disarmed most felons didn't come on the books until the 1930s. So again, like, Heller made it hard to know how longstanding something has to be in order to be presumptively lawful. And now Bruin makes it hard, I think, to know what history do you use to show the boundaries of the Second Amendment right to begin with. And it's going to keep a lot of historians busy, a lot of lower courts busy, I think, trying to sift through all those historical facts.
And I remember when I did the moot court argument in Bruin, one of the key questions was, how do you decide if something's longstanding? And is New York's law longstanding? And we were just like, no, no way. This has no precedent. But then the other side argued it is longstanding. And so how do we square Heller's longstanding regulations and prohibitions with the majority's new requirement that you have to have this concrete historical antecedent that isn't just this one-off anomaly? How do you figure that out? How do those two things square?
That's funny, that the longstandingness point, it's a really good one, especially because if it's just a matter of counting, like how long does a law have to be around? The New York law that was struck down is a couple decades older than the federal law prohibiting possession by felons, which was one that Heller said was presumptively lawful. So I don't know. I mean, the court in Bruin, I think after oral argument, we were all pretty clear, is going to strike down this law. It was just a matter of on what basis. So I don't know. But you asked the question of, well, how do we square Heller's longstanding exceptions with this new test in Bruin? I think that in some respects, this is a matter of like, technically, what is the holding of Bruin, is actually a really, really tricky question. The reason I say that is this. Bruin was a 6-justice majority. Right, Justice Thomas writes, but he's joined by 5 others. So that's a confident majority, right? And the 3 justices join the dissent. But then you have these concurring opinions. And the way that you establish the holding in a case like that is essentially you looked at what's the narrowest proposition that sort of garnered all the votes. Or that's one way you could say is like, what's the narrowest decision here that garnered all the votes? Which on the one hand should be a problem. There's 6 justices join this majority opinion. It's the holding, no problem. Bruin adopts this new historical test. That's now the test going forward. But what muddies the waters a little bit is that Justice Kavanaugh writes a concurring opinion joined by Chief Justice Roberts. They're 2 of the 6. They're 2 of the ones in the majority. And in that concurrence, they literally cut and paste, like reproduce that paragraph from Heller that has the longstanding exceptions in it, like felons and the mentally ill and sensitive places and all that. They literally cut and paste it and say, essentially, with this understanding, we join the majority. So that kind of suggests that they, at least, whose votes are essential to make the majority, they believe that Heller is consistent with Bruin. Well, that's one view. But then the Bruin majority apparently refused to put that paragraph in. Like Justice Thomas apparently wouldn't put that paragraph into the majority opinion, which is, I don't know, odds. I mean, I think if he had done that, it seems like he would have, I don't know, headed off that concurrence. He would have kept Kavanaugh and the Chief Justice fully on the majority and not entering this sort of separate qualifying concurrence. I would have loved to be a fly on the wall when they were trading drafts and just trying to figure out, like, what can we all agree on? And it seems that maybe Thomas and, I'm guessing, Gorsuch and Barrett and Alito just were not willing to reproduce that Heller paragraph, even though some of them, including Thomas, signed it the first time around. So it's a long way of saying we're really going to have to see how the lower courts do their best with this, because squaring the circle here, I think, is actually pretty hard.
It's almost like everyone believes that just taking Thomas's majority opinion on its own would not uphold those longstanding prohibitions. And maybe that's what Thomas and Alito and Barrett and Gorsuch want. But obviously Kavanaugh and Roberts don't want that. But they felt like they had to write this separate concurrence to make sure people still took Heller seriously.
It's a funny thing. I mean, you know this from working on these cases for your court, but the court in Bruin could have just said, look, we're going to do a different thing than Heller did. Like, Heller didn't actually address this question about what the test should be, so we're telling you what the test should be. But instead, what Thomas does is, in the majority opinion, really self-describe Bruin as an application of Heller. He's like, no, no, no. All we're doing is what Heller said all along, which is you just do history. It's history all the way down. Don't consider the modern costs and benefits of gun rights and regulation. Don't look at how many lives are being saved or impacted. Like, that's not part of the calculation. It's just about history, which is just such a bold thing to do, given that that's not how the lower courts have read Heller for 14 years. I mean, every federal court of appeals has been applying a test that includes both history and some of the contemporary costs and benefits. And Thomas essentially is saying, you've all gotten it wrong. Every single federal court of appeals that's been applying this test has gotten it wrong for 14 years. You misread our opinion, which is, I mean, that's a heck of a thing. It's rare that the court comes in and says, there's not a circuit split here. It's not that the circuit courts are going in different directions and we got to pick one. No, they've all gone in the same direction. And we're saying that direction's wrong under our own precedent, the precedent they've been applying. It's bold.
Yeah. So adding on to that, now that we're starting to discuss Heller, what, in your opinion, did Heller really say about caring outside the home and about using means and scrutiny?
It's a great question. So I'll take them in order. So the first question is, what does Heller say about carrying guns outside the home? It doesn't say anything specifically because it didn't have to. The plaintiff in that case, Dick Heller, just wanted to have a handgun at home for self-defense. And the majority opinion is very, very focused on that. Like the scene, the paradigmatic scene in Heller is a person defending himself. It's kind of a gendered looking opinion, himself against an invader, like a home invader criminal or something like that. Now, having said that, I think there's a very strong argument that the right to keep and bear arms that Heller describes just logically has to extend outside the home to some extent. I mean, if you accept Heller, which I do, is precedent, then I think that the right to keep and bear arms has to extend outside the home, at least to some extent. And Heller didn't say that specifically, but I think it's kind of implicit, right? Like one way to look at it is that the Second Amendment refers to a right to keep and bear arms. Heller was about keeping and Bruin is about bearing, right? Like carrying weapons at home. So I think that's fairly implied. The real hard question though is, you know, what kinds of regulations are permissible in public places as opposed to in the home? And one thing that to me anyway is pretty clear from the history, although the majority gives it, I think, pretty short shrift in Bruin, is that the government has always had way more authority to regulate guns outside the home than inside the home, for the obvious reason that when you take a gun outside your home, then you're implicating a lot of other people's rights and interests. And that's just different than when you're having a gun in the home for self-defense. The law recognizes the home as the castle. Your self-defense rights are at their highest in the home. So it kind of makes sense that the government would have a more limited regulatory authority there. And I apologize, what was the second part of your question? I got so focused on the inside and outside the home.
Absolutely, no worries. The second part of the question was about what, in your opinion, Heller said about means and scrutiny, especially because Thomas read Heller to say that you can't use them.
That's right. So this is actually, like with the first part of the question, maybe this is why I got them all blended in my head. Heller, I don't think actually says you can or can't use means and scrutiny. What it definitely says is that DC's law, which again was a total flat prohibition on handguns in the home with a few exceptions that really didn't amount to much, that goes too far. What's tricky, and this is where people sometimes read it to reject means and scrutiny, is that Justice Breyer's dissent in that case would have accepted, okay, there's an individual right to keep and bear arms, but this law should still be upheld and used some form of means and scrutiny, which the majority said, well, we disagree with you that this law could be upheld under any of our tiers of scrutiny. It just goes too far. That to me is a way of saying this law would fail scrutiny, means and scrutiny. We just don't have to apply it because it basically amounts to like a total ban on handgun ownership. And we don't have to weigh in on what if there was a licensing scheme or something like that. And that's how most lower courts have read Heller. Again, like the federal courts of appeal for 14 years were applying tests, which were kind of a combination of categorical historical rules and a sort of means and scrutiny. And I think that's frankly how we do most constitutional rights adjudication. It makes a lot of sense. And Bruin, I think, has really called into question whether that's going to still be the way we do Second Amendment doctrine, or whether now we have this sort of brand new, purely historical approach that kind of only really applies here. There's some areas of First Amendment law that look a little similar. It's Seventh Amendment's jury trial rights, but it's not a whole lot of areas of constitutional law that are purely historical and categorical like Bruin seems to describe.
I feel like there's something interesting or maybe problematic with the court more and more saying a law would just fail under any form of scrutiny, so we're just not going to apply it. And that's what you have in Heller. And then I feel like we had it in maybe Kennedy versus Bremerton, one of the free exercise cases. And then it kind of leaves this void of, well, what are we supposed to do? If you just said you don't have to do anything in this case, but then that's the extreme. And there's going to be a bunch of other more ambiguous cases where the question is left to lower courts. And talking about New York's law, I know DC's law in Heller was especially severe, but do you think New York's law is just as severe or just as much of an anomaly as Heller was?
So I have to say first, your first observation in the release is really perceptive. This is the kind of thing that makes appellate lawyers' heads hurt. It's like when courts assume for purposes of reasoning something, but don't actually hold it. And then like later, what do you make of what did that case really say? I mean, a good example of that is here in the context of Bruin, where in the lead up to this case, one of the big central questions has been, and this is going back to Hannah's question from earlier, does the Second Amendment extend outside the home? And that comes up in cases involving restrictions on public carry of guns. The way that the vast majority of lower courts have dealt with that is to say, we assume that the right extends outside the home, but we're going to uphold this regulation anyway. So like, even if there's a right to carry a gun outside your home, the government can still tell you you can't carry a high capacity magazine or whatever, right? And that's tricky because like all those courts assuming the first question that it does extend outside the home, but not holding that, kind of leaves open what is the status there? Like, do all those assumptions add up to a holding? Like, what do we really do with it together? So really good point. And then your second question was about New York's law and really how strict is it in practice. And on this one, I kind of have to plead ignorance, because I think the court actually has to plead ignorance. Like, one of the things that's striking about Bruin, I mean, as you know, from having looked at this case, is that there was no trial. Like, there's not a record like you might expect. So in order to know how strict this law is in practice, we would want to know things like, well, how many people apply? How many people get denied? On what basis? Like, what's the geographic differences? Like, that kind of stuff. And we just don't have that evidence. I mean, we know the experience of these two people, and we know what the legal standard is, at least as the New York courts have articulated it. I'll say it sounds pretty strict to me. Like, in order to satisfy what's called the proper cause requirement that you need to show in order to get permit to carry a concealed handgun in public, you have to show something like that you've been the subject of threats, or that you've got a stalker, or that you're carrying big amounts of money, you've been threatened by crime or victim of crime before. That sounds really stringent. So I wouldn't be surprised if this is very hard to satisfy. That's certainly what a lot of gun owners report. That wouldn't surprise me at all, but it's not in the record. And normally courts focus on like, well, what are the facts we know? And so we just didn't know that when Bruin was brief. So it'll be interesting to see in the response to this, how New York changes its licensing scheme. Like, I don't think it's going to do away with licensing entirely. The Supreme Court very clearly says you can still do some forms of licensing, just not what you're doing now. So maybe we'll get some more data going forward and figure out how this stuff actually works.
So my question is touching on New York's law and how states formulate laws, but how different really are shall issue regimes and may regimes? Because New York's law is a may issue regime, and there's kind of a wide ranging variety of shall issue regimes, because legislatures have to consider the various needs and interests of their constituents, right? So how different are those two forms of regimes?
So this is something that I wish, frankly, more people in the debate thought to ask, and I wish they had your insight, Hannah, because you're exactly right. So I'll start by saying like what the simple division is, like how people tend to draw the line, and then complicate that line. So the simple division is this: may issue regimes are those where the licensing official has some discretion about whether to grant a permit. Usually that means you have to show good cause or proper cause. The definitions vary across the states, but you got to satisfy the licensing official. You have some kind of special need or reason to carry a concealed handgun in public. So like discretion is usually the key thing in the may issue states. And that includes not just New York, but California, depending on how you count it, California, Connecticut, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Hawaii, Delaware, Washington, D.C. Then there's the shall issue states. And the way that people usually characterize these is they've got objective criteria. And as long as you satisfy the objective criteria, then you get your permit. So it could be things like you pass a background check, or you haven't committed a disqualifying crime, or that you satisfy training requirements, right? But they're described as being more objective. And then there's a third category, which are the permitless carry states, sometimes called constitutional carry states, of which there are now more than 20. Even like back in the 80s, there's only one, which is Vermont, but it's become more popular. And in there, it's exactly what it sounds like. You don't even need a permit. As long as you can legally own a gun, you can carry it in public. So your question is about, well, what about the difference between may issue and shall issue? Is it really that bright of a line? And the answer to that is no, because even in those states that are categorized as shall issue, some have requirements which preserve some amount of discretion. Like some of them have, for example, good moral character requirements to get your permit, right? Which is kind of hard to say that that's a purely objective thing. It's not like 15 hours of active firing at a shooting range for practice. Some of them allow the licensing official to deny a gun to a person who appears dangerous to themselves or others. Again, that's not totally an objective criteria. And it's not just New York and California. I mean, these are Georgia, Alabama, like southern states. So we're thinking about having very strong gun rights and strong gun culture. So I think that some of the may issue states like New York are going to try to adopt some of those approaches, which the Supreme Court said explicitly are presumptively okay. And then if they end up being too stringent, the court signaled, well, then we'll look at shall issue and maybe we'll strike down some of those statutes. But I think that's where we're going to see a lot of legislative activity is kind of moving from the may issue to the shall issue model and kind of exploring how broad can a shall issue regime be and still satisfy Bruin.
I remember really tussling with good moral character. That one was hard because saying someone's a good person, I mean, I don't really know. We ended up saying, well, good moral character, it has to be objective. So they're not a felon, basically, is what it would be. Yeah. But you can't like put them through a lying test. You can't like ask their friend if they're a nice person. That would just be so subjective. And so that's a really hard standard.
What you're putting your finger on there is the same question I have about the New York one is I really would want to know how it works in practice. If the good moral character thing really just is, have you not committed a disqualifying offense? Like, are you not a fugitive from justice? Like, then it does kind of reduce to an objective criteria. But I want to know the same thing about the New York law. Were they looking to objective criteria for proper cause? Like, it's an objective thing. Have you been the victim of a crime? That might be too stringent, but that's different from it being too malleable. It's sort of two different problems you could say here. One is it's too much discretion. We don't like some bureaucrat having ultimate control, right? That's one potential problem. But that's different from being too strict because you could have a discretionary system that's really easy to satisfy, but it's a problem anyway because there's randomness, there's bias, like all kinds of things creep in. Or you could have a system that's totally objective, but super strict. Like you got to do 200 hours of training before you go in public and whatever. Like that's objective. There's no moral character fuzziness, but it's probably too hard to satisfy the Supreme Court. The court seems bothered by both of those things in the New York law. And I get the discretion point, given how sort of nebulous the legal definition is, but I really would want to know more about its application to say just how stringent it's been.
We're jumping a little bit, but talking about something else that I think has been weighing heavily on my mind, the practical implications of this case, as we see, like you were talking about, gun violence is on the rise, just generally in a variety of forms. And Justice Breyer really notably began his dissent with this litany of statistics about the rising threat of gun violence in our nation. Thomas kind of ignored it. And Justice Alito said it has no relevance at all. Can courts and legislators still legitimately point to empirical evidence as a way to craft and uphold gun regulations?
I think they have to. I mean, I just don't think there's any way around it. And partly this is going back to where we started and talking about like, how are we supposed to apply this supposedly purely historical test? And I just don't think there's any way to do it except identifying what is it that the founding generation cared about when they regulated guns? And is that relevantly similar to why we care about regulating guns today? And that's going to involve empirics. So, I mean, to make that concrete, then Judge Barrett, when she was on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, wrote a dissent in a case called Cantor, which is about the federal felon prohibitor. And one of the things she said in her dissent was that history and common sense are in accord, that the founding generation understood, just as we do today, that dangerous people can be disarmed. Now, that's a broad historical principle. She's an originalist. She's pulling this lesson from history. It kind of, I think, raises the relevance of empirical evidence to show, well, what people are dangerous. The framing generation had their conception of who was dangerous. It's totally different than the one that we have today. I mean, in some ways, way broader, in some ways, way narrower. I mean, they disarm Native Americans. They disarm people on the basis of the color of their skin. We don't do that anymore. Thank goodness, it's unconstitutional. But it's also narrower than the view that we have. They didn't disarm domestic abusers, and we do. Again, thank goodness. That's because our conception of what's dangerous has changed. So how do you know what's dangerous? Well, empirical evidence. To me, it's all going to come back to why we regulate guns, and that's hopefully on the basis of evidence. So I think it's still going to matter. It's just going to be a little more obscure because it's going to have to be argued through this historical lens. And I guess I should also say that I don't think legislatures have any choice. This is what they're elected to do, is to make decisions about, at least with regard to gun laws, which kinds of laws do or don't promote public safety. And different legislatures are going to come to different conclusions on that. But I think that's kind of the nature of the work. It's incredible to note that basically 12 hours after this opinion came out, the Senate, for the first time in literally 30 years, passed a major federal gun regulation, which was signed into law 2 days later, the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. That's a whiplash day for gun rights and regulation. And it includes things like support for what are often called red flag laws, extreme risk laws, which obviously didn't exist in 1791, because almost all of them have been adopted in the last 5 years, but which I think fall within that tradition of disarming people thought to be dangerous. And they're supported by, in my view, some strong empirical evidence. So I think that's how it's going to work. But it does, on its face, make it harder to make these empirical arguments.
I want to go back to what you said about Congress, because I was feeling like the court timed their decision to drop right when Congress was on the verge of passing this gun legislation. So it'd be like, okay, we have this far-reaching decision coming out, but don't worry, it's not that bad because Congress is still doing stuff and doing their job. Do you think this decision does possibly threaten any of that legislation?
I have to say, I spent that day just, I could not figure out how this would interact with the consideration of the act. And I actually could imagine a world in which the senators who were sort of on the fence about supporting it might have said, look, we just got 135 pages of opinions from the Supreme Court about the Second Amendment. We need to take time to digest this and essentially slow walk the act. And then Congress was adjourning on the 24th, I think it was. And then the act never gets passed. I mean, I could really have imagined this taking all the wind from the sails of that federal legislation. Obviously, I was wrong. It didn't. And they got it passed. I don't think that there's anything in the act, the federal legislation that is, that should really be called into question under the historical test. I think that there's going to be litigation, I'm sure, about closing the boyfriend loophole, which the federal legislation does, making it harder for people who are under domestic violence restraining orders to possess guns, even if they're not cohabiting or married to the person who's taken out the order against them. Maybe there'd be an argument that that goes too far as compared to the historical record with regard to disarming dangerous people. I would hope not. I think anybody who's under a domestic violence restraining order by definition been adjudicated dangerous. I think that there will be litigation, I'm sure, against red flag laws, which the federal legislation provides financial support for. It doesn't create a federal red flag law, but it provides support for those at the state level. So far, no court anywhere in the country has struck down a red flag law on Second Amendment grounds. I don't think it would start now. I think that that dangerousness principle we were just talking about is plenty good to uphold the constitutionality of red flag laws. They literally just are a way of identifying people who present an immediate risk to themselves or others, which is a pretty good statement of what it means to be dangerous in possession of a gun. And then a lot of the other stuff in the bill, it's not even really gun regulation. It's community crisis intervention and mental health support, and it's funding more than it is restriction. It's, as I see it, a really important, a milestone moment, but kind of a marginal in terms of just changing what the actual status of thing is as a matter of federal law. So I'm sure there will be litigation. I'd be surprised, though, if major parts of this act got overturned under Bruin.
And then something I would love to close on is, as we are high school SCOTUS, and this is the elephant in the room, the reasoning that Congress decided to take up this issue obviously was the tragedy in Texas that unfolded. And I remember being at school when we heard that there was another school shooting, and that was pretty terrifying. And these are little kids, like literally little kids who are being shot at in school. But how will this, all of this decision-making and the timing of it affect any future legislation that might aim to protect students at school, like an assault weapons ban or raising the minimum age to purchase from 18 to 21?
I'll fall back on my answer from a moment ago that I'm terrible at predicting these kinds of things, and that I thought that the federal legislation was going to be derailed by Bruin. So I don't have a great track record in predicting these things. Here's what I would say, though. I think that what we'll see is, given the significant amount of money that's earmarked here to support the implementation and adoption of red flag laws, I think we will see a lot of action there at the state level. About 20 states have red flag laws now. The vast majority of those were adopted in the aftermath of Parkland, yet another horrific school shooting. I think there's great evidence that red flag laws help avert suicides. It's very, very hard to know the degree to which they can avert mass shootings, like when we saw at Uvalde, or for that matter in Parkland, Sandy Hook, Columbine, you know, go down the list. And one reason for that is that the mass shooting events are just so horrific and rare. And rare doesn't sound like the right word because there's a constant drumbeat of them, but they're still such a small proportion of American gun deaths that it's really tough to know what interventions might have stopped them. My usual thinking on this is the ones that we should be focused on maybe are the shootings that never happened. And those are the ones that are hardest to know. Once something like Uvalde's put into motion, or Sandy Hook or Parkland, it's easy to say, well, a gun law couldn't have stopped that. Although note that the shooters, like at Uvalde, for example, did respect the age limit and waited until his birthday to buy the weapons that he used in the shooting. I mean, there is evidence that people follow gun laws. Maybe if his birthday had been months later or a couple weeks later, after school was out of session, the shooting wouldn't have even happened. So the hypotheticals, the counterfactuals are really hard to go through, but I think what we'll see is continuing combination of marginal changes, which combined can hopefully make a big, big difference. And the last thing I'd say on it, which I take heart from, is that it seems to me that we're coming to understand more and more clearly that the role of guns in American life, both positive and negative, goes above and beyond even the extraordinary number of people who were physically harmed by gun violence. So, and schools, since you asked about it, Hannah, are a great illustration of this. The focus for a very long time when people talked about victims of school shootings was just on the horrific hundreds of, you know, children who've been killed in schools. We can't ever forget that. There's a reason why our thoughts should be front and center there. But there are hundreds of thousands of children who've been in schools where shootings have happened. And even if they weren't hit by bullets, almost undoubtedly traumatized in ways that the law should be interested to prevent. And you can say the same thing for domestic violence, for example, where the number of women in particular who were killed by armed intimate partners is extraordinary. I mean, this is the primary gun threat for women, but it pales in comparison to the number of women who've been threatened by guns. And again, if you include that, which I think we do and should, then the problem looks even more complex. And so I think the evolving conversation is headed in that direction, and I'm glad of it.
Professor Blocher, thank you so much for joining us. Your insight was really helpful in discussing this case.
Thank you both so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed our conversation with Professor Joseph Blocher of Duke University School of Law. Now that this interminable term is over, we will move back to analyzing enumerated rights and how they historically impacted students inside the schoolhouse gate. First up is freedom of the press, student newspapers, and censorship. It's a hot topic, and we can't wait to dive into the weeds with the help of legal experts, and perhaps even a high school journalist who brought her freedom of the press case all the way to the highest court in the land.
I know Elise, as the queen of high school journalism on this podcast, is really looking forward to that. But for now, please leave us a rating, drop us a review, and for more coverage of the Supreme Court by teenagers, check out the High School SCOTUS website at highschoolscotus.com. On the blog, you can read oral argument previews, opinion analysis, and interviews with eminent legal scholars. Literally everything you need to stay in touch with the court. We can't wait to see you next time.